podcast where I get to sit down and talk to an array of interesting people and talk to them about the movies that helped them fall in love with film. And this week I have on with me Brian Collins, a staff writer for BadassDigest.com, as well as the guy who brought us the horror movie a day blog, where he literally wrote about a different horror movie a day, every day, for, I think he holds the record. I think it's over 5 years he did it. It could be more. I could be wrong about that one. I do know that he stopped doing it daily at this point, but he's still updating that site. You can go check it out at horror-movie-day.blogspot.com, and you can see the link inside the post if you're if you hear people say web URLs out loud and go, I'm not going to remember all of these characters, I'll just click a link. It's in the post. You can go and click it there and read it. And oddly enough, I have to admit, when I asked him to come on, I kind of half expected him to pick a horror film, given that fact that he literally was watching horror films every day for that long. He decided he wanted to talk about Die Hard. And I mean, who turns down the chance to have a conversation about Die Hard, one of the greatest action movies of all time? Because, I mean, it's Die Hard. And you guys should start a drinking game, because I was listening back to this, and I'm like, if someone were to start a drinking game where they took a shot every time I said the phrases, I was curious, or a variation of that phrase, or when I was rewatching, because I tend to say that a lot. I think I do say that a lot generally within these podcasts. But regardless, it's still a fun conversation and an interesting one. I will put a note to the side to say that I don't want to be that guy, but two episodes running, I'm going to make audio quality comments. Is that this is the first episode out of the series that I'm recording where I mentioned last week, I generally do this through Skype, that my guest I recorded over the phone. So if it sounds a little tinny, because it kind of is, because that's how it comes off of the phone, and it's, once again, I'm gonna have to say that if the audio quality kind of plays horrible for you, I'm sorry. I was listening back to it, and everything felt understandable, so I really don't feel bad about letting it out, but I know some people were really picky, so I'm sorry if the audio quality is kind of off for you. But I won't promise, because who knows, maybe for the next 5 episodes everyone's going to be over the phone or Skype is going to crap out. I'm looking into other ways to record, so keep with me or go listen to some of the back episodes, or I completely understand. But regardless, it is a really great conversation about a really great film, and you guys, I'm sure you love it. So anyways, Brian Collins, Die Hard, yippee-ki-yay, go listen now.
We thank you one and all and wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A. But a team of terrorists.
You want money? What kind of terrorists are you?
Who said we were terrorists?
Have their own holiday plans.
And I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay.
We do it the hard way.
But the one thing they didn't plan on was New York cop John McClane.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother...
So, hi, Brian. I just like to start by saying thanks for coming and talking to me about what might just be one of the greatest action movies ever made. I don't know if we want to give it that hyperbolic stance already.
I think we can.
Yeah, I think at this point we can.
Go for it.
Yeah. So this movie, it's right now it's hitting its 25th anniversary, and everyone is kind of going insane over it. I think partly because we've already gone the year seeing the 5th installment of the franchise, which a lot of people don't really want to talk about. And another part, just enjoying the fact to remind ourselves that it's been a quarter of a decade and we've made it.
My question to you to start, which I tend to ask everyone, is like, tell me about the first time you actually sat down and watched John McClane take the Nakatomi Towers.
I don't know if we rented it or if it was on cable. I can't really remember now. I vividly remember my dad going to see it, like in theater when it was out, and then like telling me all about it the next morning. And like, my dad was not a big movie guy. He was all into sports. Like, there were maybe like 10 movies that he really liked about it, you know. So any movie that he kind of latched on to, you knew it was something that, like, oh, this will be worth checking out, you know. So, so I can't remember if he had rented it or if we just waited till it was on HBO or whatever. But, it was before, must have been around 1989, because it was definitely before Die Hard 2 came out, because then Die Hard 2 became the first R-rated movie I got to go see in theaters. You know, I saw it with my dad and my neighbor and his dad. So, it was definitely like father-son bonding type thing. But I also remember whenever I taped it off HBO, it was missing like the first like 10 minutes, I think. Like, it came in like pretty much as he was arriving at Nakatomi, and our guy was like, hey, I'll let I'll stay downstairs with the bag. And like, so like all the stuff about like scrunching the toes and, like the reasons why him and his wife weren't, living together at that time. Like, I'd seen him once the first time, but then like, growing up for years and years, like, my version of Die Hard just didn't have that. Like, it started pretty much like the second he walked in. So it's kind of funny, like, even now, like, I just watched it this week, so I haven't seen it for a while, and put it on. Like, all those, like, I watched that movie so much as a kid without those scenes that like they still kind of feel new to me, like when he's at the airport and he sees the girl and like he's just like looking at it. I barely remember this because, like, it's just like that part is not ingrained in my head like the rest of the movie.
So, do you generally just, when you're watching it today, do you generally skip that first 20 minutes? Do you go, like, I want to watch my version of Die Hard and that's it?
I should. I just, like never find, like, just like forever just skipped it and never understood why I took his shoes off. I definitely watch the whole thing now. It's actually kind of nice because it's like, again, I've seen it, the rest of it so much, it's like there's still a little bit left that's like fresh, Not that I'm sick of the movie, but it's definitely one of those movies where like, all right, I know I can go to the bathroom and I don't really need to pause it because I know everything they're going to say over the next 10 minutes.
How old were you when you first saw this movie?
So I was about, 9, I guess. 9 and 10.
So like,
that was, and when Die Hard 2 came out.
Oh yeah. So how is it that you progressed after this? Like, was it just realizing in your life that action movies were gonna be, you hoped action movies could equate to this for the rest of your life, and being poorly disappointed throughout?
Definitely disappointed now. I think when I was younger, I don't think I had much like, holy crap, like, this is the greatest action movie ever, I watched Predator and the Lethal Weapons, I liked a lot and stuff. I think it wasn't until I got probably like later in high school, and then, when action movies kind of took on the whole, the Michael Bay, like everything has to be like topping the previous movie, that I started to like really appreciate how great Die Hard was, like, on a script level, I don't think too many people queue up any of the action scenes to, like, go off their home theater, they'll take out, like, The Matrix or, Lord of the Rings or something, and it's not, like, a, holy shit, the action in this movie is just, it's just a really great movie with those elements, and I think that's why it's endured, where some of those others, even some of the sequels, like, you might like them more at the time as like a rush and like seeing them on the big screen and stuff, but they fade away, whereas you keep coming back to Die Hard.
I don't know if you've taken this particularly, just noting it over the years, because it feels so much like every year at this point, like at least in the last 3-4 years, I've noticed specifically that everyone wants to call the next action movie that's coming out Die Hard in X location.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we dealt this year with White House Down and Olympus Has Fallen, where they were calling it Die Hard in the White House. Last year, there was Lockout, which was Die Hard in space. This movie, I mean, we're talking about it today, has lived on in so many occasions to the point where people want the next Die Hard. They don't want Die Hard 27. They just want the next movie that gives them that Die Hard feeling. Has that movie actually ever come out for you?
No, I mean, there's definitely ones. I like The Rock a lot, which is Die Hard at Alcatraz. Speed is Die Hard on a bus, and I think that works really well. I think the problem is that people latch onto that. It's like, where can we do Die Hard? And they think of a location. And I think, Die Hard, it's just a building. It's not the most, it's not very exciting. What made it a great movie is, not only the character John McClane is, not the superhero type that we were used to, like not the Schwarzenegger, not the Stallone. But the villains, I was just noticing the other day, the villains are so, like, even though, like, they're the henchmen on the team, obviously Hans Gruber is, like, a great villain, but, like, somebody pointed out on Twitter, it's like, you still remember everybody's name, like, all the other guys, like, Tony and Franco and DeCarl and, all these other guys. It's like, name one bad guy in any of those other ones, apart from, like, maybe Speed, where there's only one bad guy, so it's a little easy to remember. It's like, how many of those other ones, even if you like them, can you really, like, vividly remember the personality of the different villains? And I think that's probably what makes it great, too. It's like, one of my favorite little bits in the movie is probably when Hans is trying to get the code from Takagi, and then, in the background, like, Theo and Carl have this little bet going on over whether or not that Hans doesn't even know about. He gives them this look like, what the hell are you guys talking about? And, like, I just love that. Like, it's just a throwaway little thing, but it helps make that movie so much more memorable, because, like, you feel that these guys exist, like, when we're not looking at them, Like, so many of them are just, like, they spontaneously appeared in the universe when it came time to go take over the football game or whatever the hell they're doing. And the Die Hard guys, like, really have that personality going for them.
And at the same time, I don't know if you feel this, but it felt like a lot of the ancillary good guys, which, funnily enough, were the incompetent ones. Like, we tend to see in movies like this, always the henchmen are the incompetent ones. The bad guys are the incompetent henchmen, where we get to laugh at them throughout the movie. But in this case, it was the other way around. All of the bad henchmen were kind of good at what they were doing, while all of the ancillary good guys were bad at what they were doing. And you almost forget their names. Like, I know Agent Johnson and Johnson mainly because of that joke that they run throughout the movie, but I literally finished watching this movie around 5 hours ago, and I can't tell you who the captain is, what his name is.
Robertson. The guy from the Breakfast Club?
Yeah, the guy from the Breakfast Club.
Yeah. Dwayne T. Robinson. Another guy I like in that movie, I don't know the name of. He's the guy that's kind of like just sitting next to Al Powell most of the movie. He's kind of like an in between Powell and Robertson. I like him a lot. I don't know his name, but yeah, I mean, that definitely, like, Robertson's an idiot. And that's part of the plan, is they're counting on their incompetence. They're counting on them to, like, turn the power off, like, that's exactly what they need and that sort of stuff, so.
But at the same time, there were things I noticed in this movie, rewatching it today, that kind of played strangely weird for me, that I wonder how funny the editors found it when they were cutting together this movie. Because I remember, there's a scene where the police are first bombarding Nakatomi. They're sending all of the SWAT teams over, and, it's another incompetent moment. But there's this tiniest moment when the team is actually running up and they're going through this bush, and there's an actor who you see respond to what I can only assume he got pricked by the bush. And I refuse to believe that that was a written-in moment, that just really happened. And he must be really pissed that they're like, oh, they kept that in the movie. And I actually feel like that is kind of why Die Hard works as well as it does, because when you strip away all of the John McClane is the greatest anti-hero that we end up loving, who just makes those jokes. He's like, I'm not Rambo, you know, kind of jokes. When you strip away Hans Gruber as this wonderful villain who we'll get to in a bit, or even just watching Miss Gennaro throughout the movie, it's those tiny moments where we get to see real action occurring within the film. What is it that you feel when it comes to all of the stunt work within this movie? Because, I mean, this movie, within the last 30 minutes, we see Bruce Willis rappelling down the building. Well, I'm guessing it's not Bruce Willis, but you know what I mean. Rappelling down the building using a fire hose. And things like that, we almost don't see today in that way anymore.
Yeah, I know. I mean, because obviously this is 1988, so that, you know, it's not like they had computers to trick everything and, you know, all the fancy wirework and stuff that they have now. But it's funny because I was watching, you know, on Blu-ray. It's only like the second time I watched it on the Blu-ray. And, like, one bad thing about new technology, it really makes stunt doubles pretty obvious. When he's fighting the first guy, we got the his brother, and he goes down the stairs. The guy doesn't even have, like, even remotely the same hair. He has, like, Joe Pesci hair, you know, from Goodfellas. And he's, I'm like, wait a minute, that's not Bruce. But yeah, I mean, that jump still works great. I mean, I'm sure it was just, you know, like a roof set somewhere. But the whole sequence is just cut together so well. And I always love is, like, this one shot of that goes, like, pretty much from the other side of Los Angeles to show the explosion going off. And I'm like, isn't that nice? Because nowadays, everything's always shot so up and you can't even tell what's going on. You know, it's like, here's a movie that, like, wants to show you, like, what this might look like from your house. You know what I mean? Like, rather than all super close up, which probably most of the time is just there to hide, you know, things like stunt doubles and CGI effects and stuff. So, can I think of the other, there's two other big stunts. Oh, when he's up on the roof the first time, and they sort of like, you know, and then the three, you know, Carl and the other two guys, they show up and they start shooting at him. He kind of just, like, slides down this, like, I don't know what you call it. It's like a roof vent type thing, you know, at an angle. He just slides down that, and it almost sounds like for a second like he fell off the roof because he just keeps screaming. It's just such a grounded movie in that regard. I think that's part of why the sequels, especially the last two, really just didn't get it, you know, because it was like, here's Bruce, clearly CGI'd, like, running around on a jet that's clearly CGI'd into the, you know, like, everything is green screen and, you know, just has that phony feel to it. And regardless of what's going on in the movie, like, I just can't get into it as much because I'm constantly distracted by the fakeness of it, you know. But, I mean, 25 years later, I still can't spot, other than that one stunt double, you know, I can't spot, like, oh, that's a bad effect, you know, like, that doesn't look right.
So, like, pulling it into the characters of this movie and kind of discussing John McClane a bit, there's a moment within this film early on where we kind of define John McClane, and it's through the conversation that he has with Hans where they're first talking to each other, they're first trying to figure out where they are, and Hans is trying to figure out what kind of a guy he is. He's making him akin to John Wayne, to Marshall Dillon, and Rambo. Yeah. And he kind of just laughs that off and throws in the name of Roy Rogers, this kind of, like, silly singing cowboy kind of person. And he even makes that joke, you know, I kind of like the sequin shirts, you know.
Yeah.
And it's weird enough to think about it that now, talking about this movie, John McClane is going to be a reference point for every movie going forward, yeah, where they're going to have the bad guy ask, if are you John McClane? but I'm kind of curious, like, when you first saw this movie, or at least as you were moving forward and as you were trying to kind of figure out how you loved movies, how did you kind of place John McClane in reference to past action heroes?
I think it was more like a subconscious thing. I don't think I really became aware of it, where I would say it out loud. But I think what it was is that I was able to identify with him more because I'm not in shape, and I actually just noticed again there's a scene where he takes his, where he has, he's just in the tank, in his tank top for the first time, in Holly's office, and I'm like, oh, he's not really that jacked. It's he's got a little muscle, but it's not holy shit, he had to work out. You know what I mean? It's probably just what Bruce Willis looked like, nowadays. Again, you just see these guys juicing up to be the pristine model of a man, regardless of what their character is supposed to be, And so I think there's something about that I just kind of latched on to, is that, he was able to get hurt. He was able to, he cracked jokes. He wasn't, super skilled with all the weaponry and everything else. He missed, when he's shooting at the bad guys, he was missing just as often as they were, he was kind of smart, he used, a little bit of intelligence rather than just, running around shooting everything like Schwarzenegger would, So I think there was just more to it that I was able to, identify with. Not that I'd be, I'd be Ellis, I'd be dead. I think if I was ever going to be an action hero, if I had an action movie, that I'd want to be Bruce Willis in the first Die Hard rather than Schwarzenegger in, Total Recall or True Lies or whatever, that I almost feel like I could do most of that, and therefore, it was easy for me to get into it more.
The fact that you could see him struggling to get things.
And they carried over into the second one a bit too. There's a part where I really love him too, where he's just exhausted, and he just kind of falls off a ladder, and he's just he can't even get down a ladder anymore. He's so worn out from everything he's been doing. It's that's awesome. But, even as, 15, 20 years older or whatever, in Die Hard 4, he's, perfectly okay to, run around on a jet, even though he hasn't, he's been up doing this shit for, 36 hours at that point without sleep. It's you guys didn't even get your own movie, have you guys seen Die Hard yet?
I think it was 4 where he became pretty much invincible. He literally,
yeah.
It felt like they were okay, we're going to make it into the movie where he'll be able to say, I've been doing this for a while, guys. I figured it out.
Yeah.
And he's just cool.
Yeah, and there's a bit in 5 where his son gets injury. It's not glass. I don't think it was glass. It might have been glass. But he gets something in his side, and McClane's laughing at him. And I'm like, remember when this used to hurt you too, dude? You were up in the bathroom, pulling the glass out of your foot. Now you're making fun of your son for having a similar injury. Have you guys seen the first movie? That's what happens in the FCCs, I guess.
It's kind of funny thinking about 5, which whatever. But I remember when that marketing started up and they were going to be talking about John McClane and John McClane Jr. And I couldn't remember if he had a son, if the movies had ever mentioned that he had anything other than the daughter. So I'm kind of happy revisiting this one to see in the pictures, the son and the daughter. So they didn't completely retcon that movie.
Yeah, I've forgotten that, because it seemed, in the new one, it seemed like the son was older than the daughter, that Jack was older than Lucy, but I mean, she's clearly 3 years older than him in the first one. When Thornburg goes over, he only talks to her. She's the one that answers the phone when Holly calls. I don't think, you see him kind of in the background, but I don't think he actually even speaks in the first movie. And then, the next 2 sequels barely even mention his kids anyway.
Well, Thornburg in himself, that's a whole place of just horrendousness. When we're talking about characters who we eventually hate so much. How do you kind of talk about Thornburg when it comes to the portrayal of journalists within cinema?
No one would blink an eye about anything he did today. If Die Hard took place today, Thornburg would be fighting to be, one of the other scumbag journalists that are going to the family and being hey, what if your parents die? Because they're all the, you know, the paparazzi and all this other stuff you see nowadays, they're all shitty like that. So at the time, it was probably more, not ridiculous, but a little more like exaggerated than it feels now. Now it's just like, yep, there's another scummy journalist. There he is. I mean, that guy, I mean, because that's Dick from Ghostbusters that's sitting there, shit, Walter Peck. So he's like perfect at playing one of those guys. Like, he's not the villain, but you kind of hate him more than the villain, you know? Like, obviously he's just doing his job at the end of the day, whatever, but like, he's not like actually killing anybody, but he's just so slimy. But like, with the slightest shred of likability, you're almost like, you're glad to see him kind of pop back up, even in part two when he shows up. It's like, this dickhead again. You know, rather than like, oh, I'm not this dick. You know, it's a hard line to, you know, there's a couple actors that can kind of pull that off, and he definitely, he was one of the best, I think, during that era.
You're a Los Angeles native. Have you always been from Los Angeles? I mean, as in, have you always resided in Los Angeles? Is that where you're born?
No, I grew up in Massachusetts. I moved out here, 2005. So I've been out here for about almost 8 years now.
So you didn't know Los Angeles at the time that this film was out, but how do you... Because I think the thing about this movie, which everyone kind of gravitates to, oddly enough, is that it's set in Christmas. And it's set in Christmas in a town where it doesn't look like that typical American white Christmas.
Oh, no, not at all.
Right. And I mean, there's even that line in the early part of the movie when John is being picked up where he's like, is this Christmas music? And the Argyle responds, you know, this, of course, this is Christmas music, kind of cueing us into the fact that this is going to be a different kind of movie, a different kind of action movie. But just the town setting, do you kind of get an affinity towards this movie now that you're around the town, that you can see some of the places that it's kind of set up, even though it's really a tightly located film?
Oh, no, I mean, I've been to Nakatomi. Well, I haven't been inside, but it's the Nakatomi building's actually on the Fox lot, the Fox Studios. So whenever I get to go over there for a screening, you know, and I've probably like seen pictures of it in my phone. Because that's just an office building that's on the Fox Plaza at the Fox Studios down in Culver City. The address that they give when he calls 911, and they show the computer screen, and that's actually the address, Avenue of the Stars. So in Culver City, yeah, it's actually not too far from where I live. I'm not sure where it's supposed to be set in the movie. I do know that when he's talking about the guy that he's going to stay with his old captain, and she, you know, and he's helping Pomona, and she's like, oh, you'll be in the car half the time. Like, she's right. Like, that's kind of a hike outside of, like, you know, the L.A. Hollywood area. They got the geography pretty good. Lethal Weapon is one that, like, moving to LA ruined for me, I think, because, like, I watched it again last Christmas, and everything that they say about Los Angeles, like, when they're like, he's over here and he's heading that way, like, what? No, like, that's way inaccurate. Like, you know, like, when the part where they kill the... what's his name, like the general guy or whatever, and then Gary Busey takes off, like he takes off in one direction, but then they say that he's like in a completely other one, and then they cut, and like Riggs is on, like running, and all of a sudden he's on the complete other side of the city. It's like, alright, well, what the hell, like, what LA is this, you know? But that Die Hard actually, I'm actually kind of impressed, they actually kept it pretty good. And, I don't think I identified too much. I don't think it's really changed my opinion as far as that comes. I mean, yeah, it's definitely kind of weird to be here on Christmas. I remember the first year I was determined. I'm like, I'm going to wear shorts out on Christmas. And, you know, I grew up, you know, so it's freezing. weird.
That's like regular, that's like normal yeah, life for me as a Caribbean resident.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always found it.
That's probably why I moved away, because I hated the cold weather so much, you know, living in Boston. but it definitely feels, you know, I missed like the fall weather, and, you know, New England is awesome. And it is, you know, a little homesick when it's so warm and unseasonal, you know, on Christmas. But people try. I mean, there's a neighborhood not too far from us where, you know, they have, like, the whole neighborhood decks their houses out, you know, with Christmas lights and everything, and they blow fake snow around and stuff, so, you know, it gives you a little taste of it.
So do people in Los Angeles just generally not decorate for Christmas at all?
No, you see it, but not to the extent where I used to see it, you know, back home. But then again, I mean, all, you know, there isn't as much suburbia here where I am. You know, I mean, I kind of live in a suburban town called Sherman Oaks with a lot of houses, but, like, most of where I'm going around is, like, office buildings and studios and, you know, stuff like that. So it's like they wouldn't really decorate that much anyway. But if you go a little bit north of L.A. into further up into, like, Northridge and the San Fernando Valley and stuff, you'll see more Christmas stuff. And, you know, you still see Christmas tree lots. And I think it's just that because of, like, the cold weather and, you know, that sort of stuff not being here just kind of, like, deflates a bit of it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had this weird association with Christmas because, as I said, and everyone knows this, I'm from Jamaica, so I went... Was it 19 years of my life before I ever actually saw snow? And Christmas has always been this time where it's really about what's inside the house rather than what's outside. Even though whenever I'm watching films, it's like, oh, it's a wonderful white Christmas with the big trees and all the decorations. I'm like, it's this weird thing that setting and weather can do to you, which I think is something that kind of defined itself within this movie. But bringing it back a little bit to John McClane, I found it really interesting seeing how I mentioned the association with all of these pre-American heroes and even the mention of Rambo, because in that last scene when John is kind of facing off against Hans Gruber towards the end, when he's walking up with the guns, and he kind of has that same posture and...
Yeah.
And just demeanor that we kind of see at the end of the first Rambo movie, or even First Blood 2, when he walks into the general's building and he just kind of shoots up the whole building out of frustration. Like, it felt so, it's a great moment.
Shot.
It felt so purposeful that I just went like, yes, that's like the number one filmmaking moment that I would take out of this movie if I could. Because this movie generally doesn't look that special on its own. Would you say? Like, it's not the prettiest.
So I'm saying, plus, like, it's not like a movie you watch to appreciate the visual, like, spectacle. I mean, it's a movie that, unlike any action movie that's come out in the past, like, 5-6 years, it actually has a real script. You know? They made the movie before they had the release date set. So, you know, they actually had time to, like, finesse it and actually make it good. And John McTiernan, you know, like, whatever happened to him later in his career, you know, I mean, he is a freaking great director. And I just remember, like, you know, like, Tim pointed out, like, whenever he's talking to Hans on the phone, on the radio, on the walkie-talkie, you know, like, they're constantly on opposite sides of the screen, like, as if they were sitting right next to each other talking. You know, like, little touches like that. It's just, like, you don't see stuff, like, putting that much care into detail, you know, nowadays. Now it's just like, yeah, let's get the giant robot and, you know, it'll look really cool when he punches the thing and knocks over the building. And it's like, yeah, okay, but why? You know, like, and no, it doesn't look cool because you shot it all close up with CGI and I can't even tell what's going on, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I don't watch Die Hard when I bought a new TV and, you know, fixed up my surround sound. I wasn't like, gotta put on Die Hard, you know. I think I put in Transformers 2, because that's like pretty much all that movie's good for, you know, like a test theater out on. But Die Hard is like a real straight movie. I mean, it works on a 13-inch screen just as well as it does on like a giant.
I would argue that the best film to test your home theater on is the latest Anna Karenina, but that's just me and my own like crazy brain.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, What if you could, and I hate to think that anyone would do this, if you could, like, literally cut out one action scene from this movie to kind of put on display to be like, guys, this is what an action scene should look like, what would be your scene?
Gotta be a whole, I mean, I'd start with the whole bit with, you know, him and Hans meet face to face, and Hans is pretending to be Bill Clay, and then, you know, like, you almost get the sense that Bruce knows right off the bat that the guy's full of shit, you know, and he's just kind of playing along with him, like, they're both playing with each other, which is kind of awesome, but then that whole shootout after with the, you know, the shoot the glass and everything else, again, you know, you have these little bits of, like, humor with the terrorists, where for some reason all loses the ability to speak German, I guess, because he doesn't understand what Hans is saying. That, you know, and it reminds us that McClane is human and vulnerable because they shoot the glass out, and then he's like, he's fucked because he has to crawl through it. And it's just a well-shot, you know, shootout, you know? I mean, I notice in a lot of movies nowadays, when they do a shootout, you have all these shots of people just firing, and then you don't see where the bullets go. Like, we know they're not hitting their target because then the movie's over, but it's like, what are they hitting? You know, they just kind of throw some paper around every now and then, and then it's like, all right. But, like, you really, like, kind of feel the impact of, like, all they're firing, you know, at the glass, at the computer equipment. I think, if I remember, McClane does take out one of the minor terrorists in that bit. I think Carl came up with another guy that, you know, got taken out there. I can't remember now. So, yeah, it's just a really great little, you know, shootout that actually has a reason, you know, there's a reason that everybody's just kind of shooting at each other, you know, like they're trying to, like, corner him in, and they can't kill him, you know, because they need the detonators, and, you know, there's a lot going on, rather than just like, oh, this is a cool building, let's shoot at it, you know.
It is, like,
It feels organic to the movie. You know, I think a lot of modern action movies, they kind of design the action scenes first. You know, they're like, let's do a freeway chase, let's do this, let's do that, and then they kind of, like, write a movie around it, whereas this, like, felt like the natural outcome of everything that had happened at that point. So, I mean, that's just a great sequence all the way through. And then I leave it on, because after that is, like, one of the best moments actually ever, when the hero's, like, crying, you know, because he's, like, pretty sure he's going to die. And, you know, you find out what happened to Al Powell, you know, like, in his tragedy, and, you know, Bruce is apologizing to his wife, and everything, and so, like, I guess that's the scene that got him the role in 12 Monkeys.
It must have been.
If I remember correctly, like, Terry Gilliam was, like, they wanted Bruce, and Gilliam was like, no, like, he's gonna be, like, the smirking Bruce Willis, you know, action hero guy, and it was that bit, and then he was like, Bruce, you have to be, like, you are here, like, this is the guy I need for the movie, not, you know, Bruce Willis, all caps, you know, you have to be this guy. So, yeah, so good. I want to watch it again.
Yeah.
It's 3 days. Like,
yeah,
yeah,
put it on, it'll be there. You'll have it in the background. I was kind of shocked rewatching this movie that they put that bit about the officer, the Al Powell that you mentioned, the scene where they're kind of talking about how he shot the child. I remember that from the movie, but I don't remember it showing up so late in the film. And it feels weird in a movie today, that would have been so much earlier and strung out for so much in the film.
Yeah.
But we literally only have that holding up for us for about, like, 20 minutes. If at all.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. And then, well, I mean, and it's perfect too, because that way, you know, when he sort of makes amends for that, we haven't forgotten about it. Because it's kind of a long movie. It's a little over 2 hours, which was pretty long back then. You know, most movies back then were like all 90 minutes, you know. So, so we find out that, you know, he doesn't shoot because of this thing, and then, you know, and he has to shoot Carl a few minutes later. It's like, that's still kind of fresh enough in our head to make us realize, like, how great of a moment it is. Whereas now, you know, like, it could have been, like, an hour and a half later, and you would have been like, huh? Oh, that's right. Like, later, somebody might have reminded, you know, like, oh, it's cool because he shot the, you know, oh, that's right, I forgot, you know. So, yeah, it's perfectly timed.
We kind of talked about it a little bit, but I just want to ask to see if there's anything more there, because I feel like we didn't really go that far. I'm curious about, like, you mentioned that you first saw this movie when you were around 9, 10, and it kind of led closely into Die Hard 2. It was very much a touchstone film for you and your father. What is it, the kind of movies that you then moved forward, that you kind of identify as a you and your dad kind of film that you grew up watching throughout?
There weren't too many. Because, again, my dad wasn't really into movies that much. Like, a lot of stuff I watch is horror. He hated horror. So, I mean, that kind of threw everything out the window there. He definitely watched, like, a lot of the action movies. So, like, Lethal Weapon, you know, Speed, Cliffhanger, I remember watching them a couple times. And then a few comedies. Like, he liked, he both liked Vacation a lot. And, Caddyshack, like that. And I think Fletch was actually the last movie I did watch. That was definitely one we both, like, you know, like, one of us would put it on, the other one would kind of walk into the room and be like, oh, that hurt, cool.
Is it still watch, that kind of movie for you guys?
I would like to think of it.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear.
9 years ago. No, that's all right. So that's actually why I watched it the other day. The other day was actually, you know, sure his death, so I put it on because I knew I had to kind of revisit it. I'm like, yeah, I'll watch it today, tribute to my dad. He was the one that kind of introduced me to it. And joke that he's lucky that he left before Part 4 and 5 came out.
Oddly enough, I was looking to see if you had done any writing on Die Hard, and I couldn't really find anything too quickly, but I found a tweet that you sent out earlier this year. Isn't it funny how those things still exist after we've sent them out? Saying that you wouldn't mind to see a Die Hard 6, which goes the Fast 5 route.
That's the one thing I've always liked about... there's this... Like, the one thing that they kind of carried throughout all the movies is that McClane was kind of, like, he's like a blue-collar guy, and he always kind of, like, found these, like, sort of fellow blue-collar dudes to get along with. Like, I love, in the third one, a truck driver guy that he comes with, a guy that just, like, he's like a walking trivia, you know, bank, and Jerry the truck driver. But, you know, in the second one, he's got Marv the janitor, and then in the fourth one, he's got, the blue-collar guys nowadays would be computer hackers, you know, so he has, you know, the kid and the Kevin Smith character. And then the fifth one, he gets kind of has a little chat with the cab driver at the beginning. So there's always just, like, this sense that, like, McClane can kind of like, get along with people that aren't telling him what to do, you know? And I always like that. And they built up the straight sort of like cast of supporting characters, especially the third film. I loved all the cops in the third film. And one of the reasons I was really disappointed in Part 4 is that, you know, it seemed like everybody that on the NYPD had retired except for him. You know, like where were all the cops that he was with in that one? Like that it wasn't good to see those guys again. But yeah, I think it'd be funny to just have like, you know, Al Powell and have Marv the janitor really just come back with no reason whatsoever, but like who cares at this point,
like,
you know?
Like, would it be weird at the same time to have a reunion of all of the bad guys of the Die Hard series? We have, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of them are dead at this point, but I'd find it funny to get a moment where Timothy Olyphant gets to talk alongside Hans Gruber.
Yeah, I don't know about it in a movie, but I think that would be like a great Q&A panel. You know, like have all the actors, have Jeremy Irons and Tim Olyphant and Christ, I'm blanking on his name, Alan Rickman, William Sadler, you know, like have all those guys kind of get together and talk about being like, you know, the nemesis of John McClane. Because that's kind of like an honor at this point. I mean, that's another reason that 5 kind of sucked. It was like, who the hell are these guys? Like, you know, the guy, I've seen all of them maybe in like one or two other movies. You know, like they got these dudes to be the villains in a Die Hard movie. Like, that's, you gotta earn that, man. You gotta be like somebody kind of awesome. You know, I mean, I think the character Tim Olyphant played sucked, but Tim Olyphant's a great actor, and like, you know, him I could see is like cool. You know, if they wanted to have a younger villain, you know, like that's a good choice, I think. But I don't know who the hell those guys were in five. So yeah, they can sit the panel out. The other four.
I mean. I know a lot of people give Live Free or Die Hard a lot of shit, but I actually kind of enjoyed that movie. I mean, it might be a lot of Timothy Olyphant bias going into it, but, you know,
yeah.
Running on jets.
I'll have to watch it again. I just remember the first time I watched it, I was like, all right, that's a fine action movie. Like, and I appreciate that, you know, he kind of toned, like, the CGI stuff back, like, a lot of it. He had a lot of practical stuff in there, and that there were good action scenes, like the one, you know, in the tunnel with the car flipping over and everything. But I was like, how is this a Die Hard? Like, it just, like, nothing, except for the fact that he had a daughter named Lucy. Like, I'd never felt like I was watching a Die Hard movie. And I thought, even though 5 is probably a worse movie overall, I felt 5 did a little tiny bit better of, like, feeling more like it was actually John McClane again. I mean, it sounds stupid, but I swear, I think it's the hair. Like, McClane should have his bald hair, or like, his receding hairline, rather than just be a bald dude. Because then, you know, he's a bald guy, he's just every other Bruce Willis character, you know? I mean, Bruce does not put much effort into his movies anymore. Like, that's, you kind of just know that going in. You know, unless it's like a, you know, especially the action stuff, I should say. Like, you know, he's great in Moonrise Kingdom and in Looper, you know, because he's kind of like left out of the action for the most part in that one. But, you know, like anything that's like a big, like Red 2 and, you know, the Die Hard sequels and Expendables and stuff, he's just Bruce Willis, you know, like he's not playing a character anymore.
Well, I mean, there's a big argument to be made that around 60% of Bruce Willis movies are technically Die Hard films because he is John McClane in every one of them.
Yeah. Armageddon's just Die Hard in space, and Fathoma's also Die Hard in space.
Can we therefore say that Death Becomes Her is Die Hard the romantic comedy?
And let's see, I want North. Die Hard in a bunny suit.
Oh, man. I mean, it's endless. But I guess to cap this off, because I think we're reaching the eventual end of how far we can take Die Hard, and we hope one day Hollywood really realize they've reached the eventual end of that story as well. What do you hope? I mean, I've mentioned it, I think, around 3 times, and I'm going to say it one more time. It is the 25th anniversary. What do you hope that audiences of today watching Die Hard for the first time would latch on to when they're already being bombarded with all the Pacific Rims, all the Reds, and all of the much larger action movies of today, which have become standard?
Yeah. I'd hope that they just appreciate the fact that it's a you know, a character movie first, you know, not, you know, there's a lot of action in it, you know, and it's pretty, I mean, I remember at the time, like, it was more action-packed than a lot of different, you know, sort of action movies where you'd have, like, you know, maybe a car chase in the middle and a shootout at the end, the rest was just kind of, like, building towards that, and then this is, like, you know, it's just shootouts, there's action everywhere. It's tame compared to the stuff now. So I would hope that people would just appreciate that it's just a really solid, great, character-driven movie on both sides. You know, again, like, the villains are just as interesting as the heroes. And then it's got, you know, a great supporting cast, characters that you actually give a shit about, you know, all the things that are just... And it's just funny, because it's like, everything you could say that's about Die Hard, it's just like... Shouldn't that be the case in every movie? You know, it's like, Die Hard's great because the hero is relatable and because we know the names of the people in it, you know? And like, why is that? Like, why is it singled out for that? It's sad that it's part of it, you know? Like, modern movies don't have that, you know? we care about the hero because we know the actor, you know? I mean, this is Bruce's, I think, second, maybe third movie ever, you know, in a lead role. You know, he was the guy from Moonlighting at the time it came out. They didn't even, I think, if I remember correctly, they were like, no, this guy can't be an action movie. I want to find a memo that says Bruce Willis can't be the star of an action movie, you know? So I would hope that they can appreciate that aspect of it, too, because now it's a little harder to, like, okay, yeah, Bruce Willis, of course he's going to save the day. Like, whereas, you know, when it came out, and even for a few years after, it wasn't like, oh, this is the action superstar Bruce Willis. I think, and I don't even think he made another action movie until Die Hard 2. I think Die Hard 2, which made even more money, I think that's when he actually kind of sort of started becoming, you know, the guy in all the action movies. You know, that's, you know, after that was like Last Boy Scout and Striking Distance and all those other ones. You know, he's always been kind of like a character. He's like an A-list character actor. I mean, he's done like every genre. He's even done horror movies, you know? So, yeah. They're going to appreciate that it was a movie that had a really great script that delivered on everything you can want, whether you realize it or not.
I have to say, like, if I had to pick, like, my favorite not A-list Bruce Willis movie to kind of point people to other than Die Hard, it would have to be Hudson Hawk. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I like that movie.
Yeah, that's awesome fun, yeah. I saw it, they showed up at the New Beverly here in L.A. last year, maybe earlier this year. I hadn't seen it in probably 15, 20 years, and I was just like, this is still fun, man. I mean, it's goofy as hell, and, like, there's a lot of bad jokes in it, but there's just something undeniably, like, charmingly ridiculous about
that
it.
That movie needs to be on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'd like to thank you so much for talking to me, Brian.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So that was the episode. I'm so happy that we had this conversation. It was so good. I'm really weird that I think this is the second episode thus far that it kind of is a father-son kind of movie moment. I mean, the other one was Ryan's with Field of Dreams. Now we have this one. But yeah, really interesting movie. I was kind of curious. It started to make me think about people's father-son movies. I'm trying to think what would be mine with my father. I mean, the first movie I have a memory, I'm not saying that I remember actually watching, but I have a memory of watching with my father, mainly because he talked about it so much, is always Nightmare on Elm Street. I just remember the shower of blood, that's all I can actually remember. And my father was like, oh, my children can watch horror movies, it's cool. But that's interesting to think about. But anyways, as always, this is the Movies You Love podcast. You can hear all of my guests through iTunes, through Stitcher, over on my website at gmanreviews.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at gmanreviews. You can just tweet me, say, hey, how you doing? I'll always reply. And assuming you say nice things, I'll say nice things back. Maybe we'll kind of get an understanding that we're both dirtbags and we can just be annoyingly fun to each other, because I do that with a lot of people, and I hope no one takes offense, because you guys should get this. But yeah, this is the outro, so I'm out. Thanks so much for listening.
Christmas trees, decorate the house with lights at night, snow's on the ground, snow white so bright, in the fireplace is the Yule log, beneath the mistletoe as we drink eggnog, the rhymes that you hear are the rhymes of carols, like each and every year we bust Christmas carols, Christmas carols.
Yo, come on, let's chat. You ain't did the man from last night, Santa, Macy's.
Yo, man, let's go eat, man, I'm starving.
Come on, man.